Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Factory Reset podcast. My name is Tommy, and this podcast is all about trying to get people to refocus on what Jesus actually said. This is the first of a series of episodes about the commandments of Jesus, or what the Apostle Paul called the law of the Messiah. In this episode, I'd like to tell you some more of my story as it relates to the law of Christ. And then I'll talk about a very strange tendency that you see in most churches today as it relates to that same subject. And lastly, I'll talk about what I think has been one of the devil's primary tactics throughout church history. In Romans 1, verse 5, Paul says that the apostles had received grace and apostleship from God to bring about the obedience of faith among all the nations for the sake of Jesus' name. The obedience of faith among all the nations. You ever think about that verse and what Paul is talking about there? Obedience to what exactly? What are we supposed to obey? What does it look like practically? Back in the fall of 2016, after about a year of reading the New Testament over and over and learning more about the early Christians, I reached a conclusion that was both exciting and terrifying. I realized I actually have to do what Jesus said. I had been a Christian for over 14 years at this point, so it might seem strange that I hadn't put that together already. And well, in a way I had, and in a very important way, I hadn't. Of course, I knew that we need to, quote, obey Jesus in some kind of way. But number one, I didn't think obedience was something to focus on too much. In my mind, as a Reformed-leaning evangelical, the big focus and challenge of the Christian life was to make sure that you don't put any hope in your obedience, but you hope only in the finished work of the cross. And number two, obedience was just kind of vague to me. It could look different for different people as the Spirit led them, and there's some truth to that. But I thought, of course, we all need to avoid things like sexual immorality and murder, blatant arrogance, and of course we should all be kind and generous. But otherwise, I had this idea that it's not really about what you're actually doing. You know, don't be legalistic. It's just about what's in your heart. And to me, the Sermon on the Mount was not a series of commands that we're literally supposed to obey, but it was a standard of righteousness that is unattainable. And that's the point. You can't do it. That's why Jesus did it for us, and his righteousness is given to us. That's how we can enter the kingdom of God in the end. But to actually try and live the impossible, impractical life that Jesus describes in the Sermon on the Mount, no, that would make us into very strange people. It would make life narrow and difficult. Trying to live that way could get you and your family killed. You could wind up poor. And God wouldn't want that, right? Well, anyway, back to the fall of 2016. I was reading some of what the early Christians had to say about obedience and the Sermon on the Mount. And I was getting extremely concerned, because they did not share my perspective. For example, Jesus said to love your enemies and not to resist an evil person. And I thought that he was just giving us like a flexible principle or something. I didn't really think about it too much, but I didn't think he was literally expecting us to practice nonviolence or something like that. I mean, I knew that some kind of non-resistance was good in some situations. If somebody verbally attacks you, somebody slaps you in the face or even punches you, it would be good not to retaliate. I wouldn't tell a Christian that they were in sin if they did hit back after being punched. But I would have said it's certainly noble not to. But if anyone was a serious threat to you or the people around you, well, then you should use force, lethal force, if necessary, to protect yourself and others. A friend of mine once asked me what Christians should do if someone breaks into your house and is a threat to your family. And I said that in a situation like that, you should, quote, put a knife through their chest. And there was something that excited me about the idea of killing someone in self-defense or in war or something. And I think part of the reason for that was maybe how I had been trained to think in this culture. You know, I grew up watching movies like Braveheart and Gladiator and Saving Private Ryan. You grow up as a young kid and you're having fantasies about, you know, saving people, and, you know, you have to, you know how it is. In my mind, Christians were not only permitted, but they were obligated to fight back or to go to war at times. It was a virtuous thing. It was good that Christians had participated in World War II and the Civil War and other conflicts like that. And so I was shocked to learn what the early Christians had to say. Listen to this. There's a couple of quotes. This is a quote from Irenaeus, who was only one link removed from the Apostle John. And he said, "The new covenant that brings back peace and the law that gives life have gone forth over the whole earth, as the prophet said, for out of Zion will go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he will rebuke many people, and they will break down their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and they will no longer learn to fight. These people," meaning Christians, "formed their swords and war lances into plowshares, that is, into instruments used for peaceful purposes. So now they are unaccustomed to fighting. When they are struck, they offer also the other cheek." Now, in addition to a teaching on nonviolence, you may have picked up on some other things Irenaeus said that sound different from what we hear today. The way he connects the new covenant with the law that went forth from Jerusalem throughout the world, the law which taught people to put away their weapons. You get a sense that he's on a different wavelength than many of us are today. Okay, here's one from Origen, who's another very important early Christian writer. And in this quote, he is responding to a pagan critic named Celsus, who asserted or suggested that Christianity had started as a violent rebellion. And so Origen responds and he says, "If a revolt had led to the formation of the Christian Commonwealth, the Christian lawgiver would not have altogether forbidden the putting of men to death. So it could not have derived its existence in such a way from the Jews, for they were permitted to take up arms in defense of the members of their families and to slay their enemies. Yet Christ nowhere teaches that it is right for his own disciples to offer violence to anyone, no matter how wicked. For he did not consider it to be in accord with his laws to allow the killing of any individual whomever. For his laws were derived from a divine source. Indeed, if the Christians truly owed their origin to a rebellion, they would not have adopted laws of so exceedingly mild a character, for their laws do not allow them on any occasion to resist their persecutors, even when it was their fate to be slain as sheep." And one more very short one from Origen. He said, "You cannot demand military service of Christians any more than you can of priests. We do not go forth as soldiers with the emperor, even if he demands this. Okay, if you listened closely, then you heard that Origen addressed two different issues there. He talks about personal attack, or the attack of a family. And so he addresses self-defense there, and then he also addresses military service, and he seems to say pretty clearly that Christians do not engage with violence in either context. And again, you get a sense for how he thinks about Christianity, how he thinks about the commands of Jesus, the laws of Jesus, that these are laws that are practiced quite literally, that they actually govern the lives of all Christians and set them apart from the world in a very tangible way. And so you don't really hear this kind of thing today. And I'm sure you know what I mean if you've been in church for any length of time. It's not how Christians talk about things today. Okay, I'm just one more very quickly. This is two quick quotes from Tertullian, who's another very important early Christian apologist. He said, "Since we are commanded to love our enemies, whom have we to hate? If injured, we are forbidden to retaliate, lest we become just as bad ourselves. Who can suffer injury at our hands?" And in another place, Tertullian says, "For what difference is there between provoker and provoked? The only difference is that the former was the first to do evil, but the latter did evil afterwards. Each one stands condemned in the eyes of the Lord for hurting a man. For God both prohibits and condemns every wickedness. In evil doing, there is no account taken of the order." End quote. Wow. That's pretty intense. You see how serious they were about the commands of Jesus. Do you ever hear your pastor say these kind of things about the commandments of Jesus? And friends, they all say this kind of thing. Those are just three of the early Christian writers. But every pre-Nicene Christian who wrote about this issue says the same basic thing. Christians do not use violence, not in self-defense, not in the military. And so being like sheep among wolves was not just an idea that they paid lip service to, but it was a reality for them. And can you imagine the kind of trust in God and the kind of love for their enemies that this would require, especially during those three centuries? And in case you're wondering, maybe these people were wrong, you know, they just misinterpreted things, or these people were in a good position to know what they were talking about. They lived very soon after the apostles. They grew up speaking New Testament Greek in the same cultures that the apostles had just been in. So there wasn't that language or that cultural barrier. They were writing from different locations and at different times within those first three centuries, and they all agree. And so to suggest that they were all somehow mistaken, that would have serious implications. Think about what that would say about the competency of the apostles to accurately get the message out to the world. And they're like this with the other things that Jesus commanded in the Sermon on the Mount as well. And so I was reading this kind of stuff, and I was shocked. And I thought, I'm actually supposed to do this stuff? I'm actually supposed to obey Jesus like that? On a certain level, I had no idea. And yet at the very same time, deep down in my subconscious, deep enough so that I was able to ignore it, I knew. I knew this is basically what I would believe if I just read the words of Jesus and looked at how he lived. And if I didn't have all this other stuff influencing me. And I think a lot of us know it deep down. We know something is horribly wrong. But it's very easy to ignore that still small voice. It's easy to suppress the truth in unrighteousness when most of the other people around you are doing it too. In Matthew chapter 28, Jesus gives the apostles and us a mission. He said to go and make disciples of all nations. And from the time he left until the time he returns, he wants us to be about two things. He says to baptize them, and he says to teach them to observe or obey all that he had commanded them. This is what Paul is referring to in Romans 1:5, the Great Commission. That's what he was trying to accomplish, of course. Jesus didn't charge the apostles to baptize people and to teach them to trust only in the finished work of the cross. He didn't tell them to baptize and teach theology. Theology is important, but it's not what Jesus highlighted as of most importance, is it? He said, teach them to obey all I have commanded you. And so if you're a Christian listening to this, has anyone ever done this for you? Taught you to obey all of Jesus' commandments? When you were first considering becoming a Christian, did anyone explain to you the things Jesus commanded so that you could count the cost and decide if you're really up for this? Or in the weeks and months after your conversion, did anyone sit down with you and explain each of Jesus' commandments to you? Here's why he commands this or that. Here's why it makes sense. It sounds totally nuts to the people of this world, but here's why he said it. Here's why we actually live this way. I was a member or a regular attendee of 5 evangelical churches in 5 different states over the course of 15 years, and no one ever taught me to obey all or even most of what Jesus commanded. Because to us as evangelicals, that would seem like rule keeping or legalism. You know, it would just seem strange, like we're focusing on the wrong thing here. And so it just wasn't really on the radar for us. And I think that that's the norm today. The things Jesus commanded are just not a priority for the church, generally speaking. Just take Jesus' commandment in the Sermon on the Mount, do not resist an evil person. Let me just tell you a couple quick stories to try and illustrate what I'm saying. And remember, the Sermon on the Mount is not just any old passage of Scripture. It is to Christians what the Ten Commandments are to Jews. These are the commands and the teachings that Jesus gave from a mountain after going through the water of baptism and spending 40 days in the wilderness. And if you know the Exodus story, you'll see the parallels. And so this passage of Scripture, Matthew 5-7, is just as central to the New Testament as the Ten Commandments are to the Torah. So a few years ago, I was at a friend's house in Maine, and he's a longtime member of one of the few mega churches in Maine. He's a very active member of his church. He's been involved with organizing and leading ministries, if I'm not mistaken. He certainly read his New Testament. And he's a very conservative person politically. He's very passionate about his right to bear arms. And he would often wear a pistol when at home in case of a break-in. And so, aware of that, I brought up Jesus' command, do not resist an evil person. And he was like skeptical, like he was looking at me like I'm playing a joke on him or something, like, where does Jesus say that? And so I showed it to him in Matthew 5, and he was surprised. And I watched him as he read it. You know, it was almost like he was reading it for the first time. I know he's read Matthew before, but somehow it's like he just glossed over it, I guess maybe in the same way that I had for years before. I have a good friend who's the son of a pastor. His dad pastored a conservative evangelical megachurch in Canada, decades of experience preaching sermons, counseling people, teaching people how to think about Christianity and discipling people. Well, a couple of years back, my friend asked his father what Jesus meant when he said, "Do not resist an evil person." And his father said, "I don't know." A few weeks ago, I was talking to the executive pastor of a large Reformed evangelical church in Upper Manhattan in New York City. And this is a pretty big church. It's large enough to have two services in New York City during COVID. And I asked the pastor, "What do you think Jesus meant when he said, 'Do not resist an evil person'?" And he looked off into the distance and thought about it for a moment. And then he said something like, "I'm not sure. I would have to look into that. I haven't studied it." And he was perfectly comfortable with that answer, and I appreciated his humility in admitting that he didn't know what Jesus meant. But I don't think he realized just how strange and tragic his answer really was. That would be unacceptable in the Church of the Apostles. You don't know what Jesus meant when he commanded that? You haven't really looked into it? Well, then why are you in a place of leadership? What kind of disciples are you making? What are you teaching people to do if not to obey all Jesus commanded? And I could go on with stories like this where people who have been Christians for years or people who are in church leadership positions either aren't really familiar with something Jesus said, or they just haven't given it much time or attention. They haven't studied it. They're just not real concerned about what it means. There may be Christians who are listening to this who just don't get what the big deal is. You may have a certain way of thinking about the gospel ingrained in your mind so that the things Jesus commanded just aren't of central importance. And you just don't think about it very much. And I get that. That's how most of us are conditioned to think today. And if that's you, please consider this. Imagine a large Orthodox Jewish synagogue, a big congregation in New York City. And the rabbi is responsible for providing guidance and leadership and counsel for hundreds or maybe thousands of Jewish people. He's supposed to teach them how to think about things, how to be faithful Jews. And one Sabbath after the service, a curious visitor asked the rabbi, "What does it mean to honor our mother and father?" Which is one of the Ten Commandments. And the rabbi thinks about it for a minute and he says, "Yeah, I don't know. I've never really looked into that. I'd have to study that." Would that be a bit strange? Yeah, it would be extremely strange, right? An Orthodox Jewish rabbi who hasn't really studied one of the Ten Commandments, isn't sure what it means, hasn't looked into it, and now he's giving guidance to a community of Jews? Well, that's not the kind of thing that you had under Moses. And in the same way, what many of us are experiencing today and how we're learning to think about things is not the kind of Christianity that you had under Jesus and the apostles. It's not the kind of Christianity that you had in the first few centuries, right after the apostles. And it's not just evangelicals. I was talking to a Catholic priest of a church on the Upper West Side of Manhattan a while back, and we were talking about how the early Christians all taught nonviolence in obedience to Jesus. And you know what he said? He said, "Well, that was a different culture, and things change." Something along those lines. And he shrugged it off like it was some insignificant issue. Most of my conversations with Protestants, Catholics, Orthodox Christians have been like this. The commandments of Jesus are just not of central importance to most of us today, regardless of what sect we're in. What is important to us is what we hold to be right theology or church tradition. That's what it's all about for us today. That's just the kind of Christianity that we've grown up in, And it's been that way for a long time. And I've only mentioned this one command of Jesus, do not resist an evil person. In my experience, many Christians are like this with a lot of things Jesus commanded. What he said about wealth, marriage, oaths, what to do with possessions. Those sorts of commands of Jesus, they're often treated like suggestions. You know, these are nice ideals. You know, maybe if we were living in a perfect world, but not really realistic, not practical. I mean, maybe monks can try to live that way, or if you want to try to obey Jesus and in that kind of way, that's good for you, brother or sister, but don't push that on other Christians. If you want, do a little experiment. If you're a Christian, if you're part of a church, ask your elders or your pastor what Jesus meant when he said, do not resist an evil person, or what he meant when he said, do not take an oath, or something else, and just get a sense for whether they have a serious, well-thought-out view of these things or not. Regardless of whether they're right in their view, just see if they've even really given it any real attention. And unless you have a very unusual church, I think you'll see what I mean. Well, how did it get this way? Why are we so unresponsive to Jesus in comparison to those early believers? Why are we so apathetic about his teachings and his commandments when even our leaders sometimes haven't thought deeply about these things? It's really strange when you really think about it. The Son of God issues a decree, and we don't really take the time to study it, understand it, chew on it. Don't take the time to see how the Church of the Apostles understood these things. Jesus comes down here at great cost to himself, not only to die and rise for our salvation, but to preach a message to us. In Luke 4:43, Jesus said that preaching the message of the kingdom of God was the reason he was sent, his message. Hebrews 1:1-2 says that in the past, God spoke to us through the prophets, but now he has spoken to us by his Son. Jesus said that he only speaks words that God the Father tells him to say. Aren't the words of Jesus kind of a big deal? Shouldn't we hang on every word that came from the lips of the Son of God? Additionally, Jesus says some pretty serious things about obeying his commandments in John 14 and 15. And I would take a fresh read through that if you haven't in a while. He says that keeping his commandments is what shows that we love him. He says that if we keep his commandments, he will ask the Father and he will send us the Spirit to be with us. He also says that keeping his commands is a condition for remaining in his love. And 1 John tells us that keeping his commandments is the evidence that we really know him. And so if we don't keep the commandments of Jesus, then we don't love him. We're not going to have the Spirit with us in a certain way. And then one of two things is going to happen. Either we get cut off the vine, we lose our saving connection to Jesus, or if you're Reformed and you don't like that theology, okay. If we don't keep his commandments, then we find out one day that we never knew Jesus at all. And neither of those is a good option, if you ask me. Right? So it seems like Jesus' commandments are a subject that we should be really interested in. So what happened to us? How did it get this way? Well, I think what's happened is exactly what Jesus and the apostles said was going to happen. It's obvious. It's right out there in the open. But most of us cannot see it. At the end of the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says that the path to life is narrow and difficult. Only a few find that path. The context of those words is the sermon he just preached, the commandments he had just given. That is the narrow path, the will of his Father. And he tells us that on the day of judgment, there's going to be many who call him Lord, Lord, but did not obey the will of his Father. They did impressive things in his name, but they were hearers of his words and not doers. And so Jesus is telling us up front what church history is going to look like. Listen, only a few people are really going to listen to me and do what I say. Most people will not obey what I just commanded in this sermon. Even most Christians, people who call me Lord, who know that I'm the Messiah, and it's going to cost them eternal life. That's what he's saying. I know this is not a pleasant idea, but just imagine for a moment that you're the devil. And you've heard Jesus say these things. You know that it is essential that people get on this narrow path and walk in his commandments and do the will of his Father if they're going to enter the kingdom at the end of all this. And you want to take as many people down with you as you can. And so what are you going to try to do? What's your primary goal? Well, maybe it will be to try and distract people from the will of Jesus' Father, the commandments of Jesus. Try to get people focused on other things, maybe even important things. Get them thinking about anything else that you can so that you can more easily derail them. Makes sense, right? And so what did church history end up looking like? Well, I think when you put it all together, when you look at it from a bird's eye view, I think what you basically see is something like this. This is extremely simplified, but something like this. After Jesus left, the church walked that narrow and difficult path in the power of the Spirit for about 3 centuries. They obeyed his commandments. They understood that Jesus started a real kingdom, that he is the Lord, the King, and that they needed to obey his commands if they wanted to enter that kingdom in the end. And so they were as serious as a heart attack about his commandments, not in a legalistic, mechanical kind of way, but because they loved him, they feared him, they took him seriously. And the result was that they were separated from the world in a very real kind of way. They wouldn't go to war. They wouldn't get divorced and remarried. They wouldn't take oaths. They practiced this amazing generosity and trust in God. They valued poverty. They broke free from sexual immorality and they lived holy lives. And there were other things as well that set them apart from the Romans or whoever. And I'm speaking generally here. I'm not saying they were perfect, but in comparison to today, yeah, it was really different. And then Constantine comes along in the 4th century, and very quickly, the church goes from being an underground, persecuted group to enjoying favor and high status. And a few good things happen as a result. The Roman Empire changed in some ways that were good, for sure. But it was nice to be a Christian now. They became rich. They became comfortable and privileged. And pretty soon they began to fight with each other over theological issues, issues which were important, for sure. But how they dealt with those issues, they began to exile and persecute heretics. They began to then persecute pagans in the same kind of way that pagans had once persecuted the Christians. And they began to go to war for the empire. They forgot very quickly about the royal law that had gone forth from Jerusalem only a few centuries earlier. And from then on, most of professing Christianity was severely derailed from the kind of Christianity that you generally had prior to Constantine. And the rest of church history is marked by things that we all know Jesus and the apostles wouldn't do. Nice, big, expensive, and elaborate buildings, the Crusades, political entanglement, all of the many wars that Christians fought in, quote, Christian Europe, the bloodbath that was the Protestant Reformation, American slavery and the other injustices that took place at the founding of America, Christians getting incredibly rich and comfortable far beyond what is necessary, while many people go without their basic needs met. A church in which divorce and remarriage, or a greedy lifestyle, or pornography addiction is not only common, but it's pretty much expected. It doesn't shock people anymore. It's just the way it is. And so, up until today, just like Jesus said, many people call him Lord, but only a few continue to walk that narrow path of love and trust and self-control and generosity and humility that the early church was committed to. Most of us have learned to ignore, or we've learned these clever ways of explaining away things Jesus commanded. Sure, you can kill your enemy if necessary, as long as you love them in your heart. It's okay. Jesus didn't really mean don't resist an evil person. Let's be reasonable. Or hey, you can get a new spouse if things don't work with the first one. Sure you can. God's grace covers it. And he wouldn't want you to go through anything difficult like singleness or working it out with a spouse that you feel nothing for anymore. You don't have to carry that cross. Go ahead, find someone who's a better fit for you. Sure, you can store up treasures for yourself while you're here on the earth. It's the responsible thing to do. After all, this is a capitalist society, not like first century Israel. Well, we can't take Jesus that literally. I mean, that would be simplistic and legalistic. You need to make sure that you'll be okay later on in life, right? Just don't let your heart get attached to it. That's all Jesus meant. Our ears love to hear those kind of things. And here's one more thing that you see in church history, and this is specifically for Protestants. That as church history unfolded, a different way of interpreting Paul from how the early Christians understood him emerged in the teaching of the church. And it began primarily with Augustine. And then about 1,000 years later, Luther and Calvin recovered Augustine's teaching. That was their foundation. They should have gone back a few more centuries, but Augustine was really their guy. And the Reformers took Augustine's teachings and they built off of that, and they removed Paul's words from their context, their Jew-Gentile context. And that created the illusion that Paul taught that what we do plays no role in salvation. And that certainly tells us what our ears would like to hear. And I'm sure you can see how that would cause us to have a more casual approach to the commandments of Jesus. And this is exactly the kind of thing that Peter warned about in 2 Peter chapter 3. If there was ever an unstable and untaught, in a sense, person who twisted Paul's words in a dangerous way, it was Martin Luther. And a lot of us in the evangelical church, we know something's very wrong there with Luther. But he's sort of a spiritual hero, and you know, we're supposed to hold him up and defend him. And no, something was really wrong there. And so anyway, what had been most important in the beginning of church history was faithful obedience to Jesus. Theology was important, but they kept it simple, and the emphasis was on how they lived, which is what the New Testament emphasizes. But what began to be most important in the 4th and 5th century was theology. And they loosened up quite a bit on obedience to Jesus. And the first thing that went right out the window was nonviolence, which was maybe the most important doctrine of the early church. And for obvious reasons, right? I mean, our soldiers are going to be Christians now, and So we can't have this nonviolence thing anymore. And so you understand why they explain that away and toss that out. But Jesus never gave us the authority to do that. And so that's the kind of Christianity that we have today, for the most part. That's what we've inherited. A form of Christianity where theology is central and actually doing what Jesus said and the way the primitive church did, it's not really on the radar. As long as you have the right Christology, the right Trinity doctrine, then you can do all kinds of horrible things Jesus wouldn't do. Think about it. Are the Catholics, the Protestants, and the Orthodox, are they devoting themselves to teaching people to obey all Jesus commanded? Is that their big focus and mission? Are they out there preaching the kingdom of God and telling people to repent and turn to Jesus and to love their enemies in the way that he did and to sell possessions and give to the poor and to stop storing up for themselves and other things Jesus told us to do and commanded? Do you even need to think seriously about that question? No. They're out there trying to convince the world to buy into their theology or their doctrines or their traditions. The Protestant evangelicals, they don't want to teach you to obey all Jesus commanded. They want to teach you the theology of Luther and Calvin. The solas, penal substitution, the imputed righteousness of Christ. They want to teach you not to trust in your own works. The Catholics want to teach you that the Pope is the vicar of Christ and that they're the one true church with apostolic authority. And they want you to understand some really important things about Mary and some other things that Jesus didn't mention. The Orthodox Church, they also want you to think that they're the one true church. And they want to tell you about the essence-energy distinction and how the Filioque was a false doctrine. And they want to teach people to feel good about bowing to images and statues. That's a big issue for them. Friends, none of those things are what Jesus highlighted as of most importance. A lot of those things, they're not even in the scriptures. So do you see the deception, how we have been derailed? We've all missed the point. When I first started to consider this perspective, it was almost like it was too much to handle. Like, how could it possibly be this bad? I mean, how could we be that deceived? The majority of what professes to be Christianity is, how could it be this badly misled? And I was venting about it to a good friend of mine as I was trying to just take it all in, and I was starting to understand the implications. And he said to me, well, the Bible does say that a great apostasy is going to happen. And I thought, wow, yeah, it does say that, doesn't it? I mean, it occurred to me, you know, I always thought of the great apostasy as something that's coming in the future. It hasn't happened yet. Oh, when will this great apostasy happen? What will it be like? Oh, maybe it's starting with Joel Osteen and Joyce Myers and, you know. But look, it's been 2,000 years almost since Jesus left. What if it started a long time ago? What if we're a part of it? What if what seems normal to many of us today would seem like apostasy to the early Christians who had a much more serious and literal application of Jesus' commands and the teachings of the New Testament? It's dangerous to compare yourself to what's normal today and to think that, oh, what's normal in my church, you know, is normal Christianity. No. Compare your church to what was normal in the church of the apostles. And all of a sudden, what's normal might start to look like apostasy. It's something to consider. As the first century Jews show us, we humans, we have a way of missing really important events as they come to pass right under our noses. And that can happen to us. Maybe you're a Catholic or an Orthodox Christian and you're thinking, well, Jesus said the gates of hell wouldn't prevail against his church, or the gates of Hades. And so it can't possibly be right that my church is this off the mark. And yeah, Jesus said that, but bring that together with the other things he and the apostles say and give it all equal weight. There is going to be a great apostasy. False teachers and false teachings will come even from within the church. Acts chapter 20. The love of many will grow cold because of the increase of sin. Many will stand before Jesus and call him Lord and then be cast out. Bring all that together, you know, to fill in the picture of what the New Testament is telling us. And think about Revelation 2 and 3. Jesus warns 5 out of the 7 churches. 5 out of 7. And these are first century churches. They had a much higher standard for themselves than we generally do. And there was a much higher cost for being a Christian at that time than there is for us, particularly in the first world today. And yet Jesus warns the majority of them. And so then, what do you think he's going to say to most of today's churches across the globe, let alone our lukewarm, rich, comfortable, Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox churches here in America or in Europe? I'm not suggesting that we're hopeless. Not at all. God is merciful. He's gracious. He is ready to receive and restore anyone who wants to wake up and follow Jesus in the way that Jesus said we need to. He's merciful. He's ready to forgive. He doesn't want anyone to perish. And I'm not saying that it's a sin to be a part of one of those 3 big churches. I think it's dangerous because of some of the things they teach. I think if you join one of those 3 big churches, you're not likely to become the kind of disciple Jesus wants you to become. But I'm just saying, whatever church we're in, we need to wake up and see this. We need to see how far we have drifted from the kind of Christianity that Jesus actually ignited in the beginning. And absolutely, God still uses this compromised gospel, the mess that we're in today, he uses it. He uses it to bring people into his kingdom. The gates of Hades have not prevailed against the church. God has his remnant, his group of faithful followers who obey him. Those people who have, quote, not bowed the knee to Baal. And those people are scattered across various sects of Christianity. There is no one true church sect. But there is only one path to the kingdom. And we all need to walk that path if we're going to enter that kingdom in the end. And we shouldn't assume that Jesus is going to lower his standards for us just because we have lowered the standards for ourselves. It's a little analogy to wrap up this episode. Imagine a basketball coach who's putting together an elite team. But he chooses the worst rejects of the basketball league. People who have been cut from other teams, they're out of shape, they're lazy. But he decides he's going to give them another shot at being on an elite basketball team. And he says to them, look, there's no tryouts. If there were tryouts to get on this team, none of you would make it. And so if you want on this team, I'm just going to give you a jersey. I'm going to put your name on the roster. And then you show up at practice. But then you need to give me everything you got. No more games, no more joking around. You got to give me everything you got. And if you listen to what I say, then you're going to be able to do things you never thought you could a lot faster than you think is possible. And so a bunch of them say yes, and they show up to practice. And the coach begins to train them, and he shows them what they need to focus on and what they need to master. And then one day he brings them all together and he says, listen, I need to leave for a few months, but I'll be back just before the season begins. Between now and then, the assistant coaches and the team captains are in charge, And while I'm gone, you all need to be about two things primarily. Number one, you all need to eat a strict diet. No junk food, no fast food. And number two, you need to continue to prioritize the basics. Shooting, passing, layups. Everyone needs to be proficient at dribbling with both hands. Everyone needs to be able to dunk. Don't get cocky and think you've got it all down, but be humble and continue to master these things. There are other things that you're going to be learning and practicing for sure, but these are the essential things. You must become proficient at these things to stay on the team when the season begins. You don't have to be perfect, but proficient. And as long as you do as I've told you, you can do it. Follow my instructions, stay focused, give it everything you have. And you need to work together now, no bickering about non-essential things or unimportant things, no unnecessary drama or division. And so the coach leaves. And for a few days, things go well. They have a couple of hiccups here and there, but they generally, they stay focused on the basics. They're working together in unity. But then one day a dispute breaks out about what color the jersey should be. And practice comes to a halt, and they waste hours debating the issue. And another day, an argument over what time practice should begin starts. And some people want 8 a.m. Some people want to stick with 7 a.m. And they waste an hour or even 2 hours some days arguing about it. And the coach never said when practice needed to start, but many of the players feel really strongly about it. And the assistant coaches are not in agreement on it. Another day, an argument breaks out about what the coach really meant when he said, everyone needs to be able to dunk. I mean, what does dunk really mean anyway, right? And they decide, hey, as long as your heart is in it, you know, as long as your intentions are in the right place, it's not so important that you actually can dunk. Surely that's not what the coach meant. I mean, that would be a bit unreasonable. Another day of practice wasted arguing and talking about it. Over the course of the next few weeks, a few keep practicing and mastering the dunk, but most of the players start to neglect it. And some new players are recruited by the assistant coaches, but nobody teaches them to dunk. They finally settle on green jerseys, since it's the color that the coach used to wear when he played, and they're really excited to tell him about it when he returns. Another day, one of the coaches asserts that a good long massage for each of the players a few times a week is really essential for success. And so they hire a team of masseurs, and they begin to make practice a bit shorter, 3 times a week, to leave time for massage. Well, then one day the coach shows up at practice, and the whole team gathers in front of him. Good news, coach, one of the captains says. We got new jerseys while you were away. Some of the team wanted red, but others of us knew that you liked green best. And so we got green, and we decided that practice should start at 8 instead of 7 since it would allow us to get more sleep. And then the coach motions with his hand to be quiet, and he picks out a random player, one of the recruits that he doesn't recognize, and he tosses him a ball, and he says, dunk. Most of us are not ready. We're not prepared for the coach to return. We're not ready to stand before the Son of Man. And I would like to invite you, whoever you are, to take a fresh read through the Sermon on the Mount and the Sermon on the Plain. And I'd like to invite you to look into how the early Christians thought about the Sermon on the Mount, how they thought about the gospel and the Christian faith. And just try to discover with fresh eyes the royal law that went out from Israel 2,000 years ago. and recenter and refocus on the things Jesus actually said to be about. Not the things your church wants to focus on, but the things he said are of most importance. And Jesus did not suffer and die because we're never going to be able to obey his commands. But he suffered and died to make us able, to heal us, to make us into the kind of people we were created to be. And if we are willing and obedient, he's going to send us the power that we need. In the next episode, I'd like to continue the discussion on the law of the Messiah. I'll address three bad ideas that I think are embedded in many of our minds that keep us from seeing what those early believers saw. May God bless you, whoever you are. Please send me a message if you would like to discuss these things. Thank you.